Case will be taken under advisement. We move to the last case this morning, Venvis versus Smith.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I represent the petitioner-appellant Joshua Resendez as his court-appointed counsel. The question before the Court today is whether an individual has a constitutional right to counsel in a proceeding under Indiana Code Section 3538.115. That statute requires that a convicted person's sentence shall be corrected if the individual is erroneously sentenced.
So here's my question, Mr. Gebhardt. I understand the theoretical arguments about 3538.115, but I have had a hard time trying to figure out what correction within the scope of that statute Mr. Resendez is looking for. And if he's not really looking for a correction, then it appears simply to be a collateral attack for which we know, outside the scope of 115, among other things, and for which we know there's no right to counsel. So can you help me with what kind of actual correction he was looking for?
Well, I understand that Mr. Resendez's motion, as he filed it, raises a number of issues, some of which I think are outside at the ambit of that statute. But as we note in the brief, at least one of which I think is under the ambit of the statute, and that is whether the sentence in cause number 043 was correctly imposed as a consecutive sentence. I think that is a legitimate issue to raise under the statute.
But is that, when you say correctly imposed, when I think of a statute like something to correct sentence, I think of situations where, you know, a trial court announces that it's going to be a concurrent sentence and it winds up getting written down in the papers transmitted to the prisons as consecutive, and so the person says, no, you know, this was really a concurrent sentence, and here's Indiana law. Now, there has to be some line between correcting a sentence and modifying a sentence, because as you've pointed out in your brief, there's a different statute that deals with modifications, and he's not. You agree that he's not under that statute?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So what's the difference?
My understanding of the intention of the motion to correct statute is that it is designed to provide a convicted person with a means of challenging the legality of his or her sentence. So I believe under, after the Robinson decision, in order to raise a challenge to the legality of one's sentence, they need to be able to identify some statutory authority that the sentence as imposed contravenes.
So a sentence is just flatly illegal, you know, longer than a statutory maximum, or in some fashion simply not permitted by Indiana law, you think could also be reached under 115?
Yes, Your Honor. In demonstrating why Mr. Resendez had a right to counsel in pursuing his motion to correct, I'd just like to make three points. First, the purpose of the statute is to establish an alternate form of direct appeal. According to the Indiana Supreme Court, the state legislature created this device as an alternate remedy for convicted persons who only wish to challenge the propriety of their sentence. The procedure was designed to provide a prompt, direct method for correcting an illegal sentence and to be a, quote, quicker and more efficient alternative to direct appeal. It can be used to raise sentencing errors that otherwise would be challenged through a traditional direct appeal, and the denial of a motion to correct may form one point of error among many in a traditional direct appeal. But the fact that perhaps most strongly demonstrates that the motion to correct is direct in nature is that the Indiana Supreme Court held that the procedure is not by nature a post-conviction proceeding.
So let me come back again. I'm sorry to be past here. But even if you're right that in a proper case 115 is enough part of the direct process that the right to counsel attaches, another way of looking at what Mr. Resendez is talking about is the authority of the parole board over him while he's serving a sentence of probation, right? So whether both of those bodies can exercise power at the same time or whether it has to be a one-at-a-time situation. And how does that describe an error that appears on the face of the one or the other judgment of conviction?
Well, I think that is a more difficult puzzle to solve. And I think that part of the problem here is that Mr. Resendez had no counsel throughout the entirety of this proceeding, from the minute he filed until the minute he sought to appeal, he was completely without counsel. So the way that he chose to present the issues that he perceived with his sentence, I will concede, are not necessarily the way that an Indiana public defender coming in with a clean legal landscape might choose to present those issues. To the extent that he has a strong argument there, I think he would need to be relying on one of the orders which was issued in connection with either his with one of the revocation proceedings. It's a little bit unclear whether post this Robinson case in 2004, whether an order would be considered, whether a problem with an order would be considered a facially apparent error or not. Clearly, it pertains to judgments of conviction, but those are not judgments of conviction in connection with those two types of proceedings. So.
In and of themselves, yeah.
I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, that's what you can do. That's fine.
Taken together, all these factors demonstrate that the legislature created a device which was intended to serve as an alternate form of first-tier review. The U.S. Supreme Court explained that the Constitution requires the assistance of counsel in connection with first-tier review, but that requirement doesn't extend to second-tier or discretionary review. And the reason for that is because at that stage, error correction is no longer the reviewing court's primary function. The motion to correct shares two important similarities to the first-tier review described by Halbert. First, it's not discretionary in nature. It is mandatory. It is as of right. The state courts have held that they are duty-bound to correct sentencing errors, so they must do so. Second, when an Indiana court considers a motion to correct or considers an appeal from the denial of a motion to correct, by definition, its primary function is error correction. I see I'm entering my rebuttal time, so unless the panel has any further questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the court. Petitioner was not constitutionally entitled to counsel to challenge a decision of a parole board. And that's what he did here, no matter what label he put on his pleading. Just because he put on the top of his pleading motion to correct erroneous sentence doesn't make it such. And here, what he was challenging, as seen by his pleading, was the decision of the parole board to revoke his probation, his parole, and run it consecutive to his probation because the sentences below were run consecutively.
So could you describe a little more what, in your view, does fall under 3538.115?
The Indiana
is it what we were talking about, kind of facially invalid sentences or a failure of the sentence to conform to what was said? What is the scope of that statute?
Indiana courts have made clear that it has to be facially erroneous on the face of the judgment.
You pick up the judgment and you say, this says 10 years, but the statute only allows 5.
Correct. Okay. Or if the court did not include something that it's required to include, for example, it left out the sentence. It said, judgment of conviction on count 1, he's remanded to the Department of Correction. That's it. And didn't say for how long. Obviously, that would be an error on the face of the record. Indiana courts have also dealt with, and in the Robinson case, the question of what happens when the court doesn't put on the judgment the amount of credit time, pre-sentence credit time, that the defendant should be entitled to. And that would be if the court did not put at all anything about credit time, that would be subject to a motion to correct erroneous sentence. But if the court did put a number for credit time, the defendant couldn't challenge it because there's nothing on the face of the judgment to say that particular number is wrong. You'd
have
to look outside.
That's where you'd either have to have a direct appeal or a collateral attack.
Correct.
A motion.
And there's no time limit on the filing of these 115 motions.
Correct.
Right? Unlike the there is a fairly rigid time limit on taking a direct appeal.
Correct. And filing a notice of appeal. But Indiana does allow, under the post-conviction rules, to file a belated notice of appeal. So if a defendant does not comply with the time limits of a direct appeal, he could seek a belated notice of appeal, and there would have been nothing to stop Mr. Resendez from doing that in this case, or from filing what is the proper mode to challenge the parole board's decision, which is a post-conviction relief petition. The post-conviction relief rules explicitly say this petition is used when a defendant is challenging the decision of a parole board. What the trial court did here is really the same thing the federal courts do all the time when a defendant files a Rule 33 motion for a new trial, and the court looks to see whether it's a bona fide Rule 33 motion or whether it's a 2255 petition in disguise. Just because the defendant labels it a certain thing doesn't make it so. The trial court has to look, what is the nature of this proceeding so I know how to proceed? And that's what the trial court did here. It looked at it and said, this is not a proper claim for a motion to correct erroneous sentence, and so it dismissed it. And the district court here properly determined that what the petitioner is trying to do is raise a non-cognizable claim in federal habeas. So the state would ask that you affirm the district court and dismiss the petition.
What was the trial court in this case?
The Superior Court?
Yes. Well, where?
In Allen County.
Thank you. It doesn't say, at least it doesn't jump out at me, so that's where it was. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just very briefly, Your Honors, going to the issue of the lack of a time limit here on the filing of the motion, it's important to keep in mind this is a system that the state designed. I agree the lack of some kind of temporal boundary here strikes me as idiosyncratic for something that's direct in nature. But it's a system the state designed. They imposed no time limit for whatever reasons they had, and it's not appropriate to bend the Constitution to suit something that strikes us as idiosyncratic in applying the Constitution to a state procedure. It's the procedure that must bend, and not the Constitution. Second, just to address the notion that the state trial court didn't consider this motion to be properly brought as a motion to correct. That's simply a novel theory that the state has put forward. I don't know that there's any evidence in the record to support that. What we have is a one- or two-sentence order from Judge Serbeck, in which Judge Serbeck says Mr. Resendez has filed a motion to correct, and I dismiss the motion. There's no reasoning there listing the reasons why he chose to do so. In the state's brief, where they discuss this issue, they cite two cases for the proposition that this occurs regularly in the state courts. But in both of those cases, the judges made a specific determination that this motion was not properly brought under the motion to correct statute. It is in substance something else. Judge Serbeck didn't do that here. So with that, I thank the court for your time.
Thank you. And Mr. Gephardt, you were appointed as well. Thank you very much. Again, you have the thanks of the court for your fine representation of your client. And we